Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Oh, we're going to be in Genesis chapter 36 today. It really deals with Esau and his descendants. It's a rather technical chapter. There are some very interesting things here, but they're more in the line of historical things than spiritual things. I was interesting as I read through the Jewish rabbis. They take this chapter as a perfect example that Esau was a heathen. And boy, they use all the different genealogies here to say how they intermarried and acted appropriately. And they even change some words that we're not sure what they mean in Hebrew to mean some very uncomplimentary things. Esau traditionally in rabbinical literature, of course, is an evil person. I don't see him that way as I look at the book of Genesis. I think he is a rather robust outdoors man that cared more about hunting and fishing and the joy of the moment than he did about religious responsibilities. I think he's a good example of a good time Charlie secular man. I don't see him as an evil person. He's rather a pathetic figure that tries to, even after the fact, still make his daddy happy. And so it's a lot of motives here that we can't really know, but we can know something about his genealogy and his history. Now, the book of Genesis is divided by Moses by this characteristic little phrase that occurs twice in this chapter. Now, these are the records of the generations of. We see that first in chapter 2, verse 4, where it talks about the generations of heaven and earth, and then chapter 5, 1, 6, 9, 10, 1, chapter 11, verse 10, chapter 11, verse 27, chapter 25, 12, chapter 25, 19, 36, 1, 36, 9, and 37, 6. And so obviously this is a mechanism by which Moses is showing us the major and minor characters. Those people directly connected to the Abrahamic covenant are dealt with in much more detail, and those who are just superficially connected are dealt with in really very minor way. I remember one time in a class, a young black man asked me, why aren't the nations of Africa talked about more in the Bible? And this is a good point to mention that. Those people and nations directly connected with the covenant are dealt with extensively. But the further geographically, and in this sense, the further away from the direct descendants of the line of Abraham that you get, the less attention is paid. So there's no attention at all paid to those nations that are outside the surrounding area, or those nations that whose history does not impact Israel's history. And so that's why the rest of the world is really not mentioned in the Bible. It's not a lack of God's love. It's a lack of the plan of this theological history. Now it says, of Esau, that is Edom. I'm surprised how many times in this chapter an allusion is made that Esau became the father of the Edomites. Now Esau, of course, is the brother of Jacob. If you go back to chapter 25, verse 25 and 30, you find that the word Esau means red, and Edom tends to be the idea of hairy. And the boy was born, he was hairy and red. Now, some people say hairy, meaning low bushes, and that's kind of the characteristic of this of Edom's territory, which is basically a high plateau. And that may be true, but I think it's connected to its ancestor also here. Now, listen to verse 2 where it says, and Esau took his wives from the daughters of Canaan. You remember back earlier, I think it's back in, about chapter 25, 26, Rebekah mentions these two Hittite women are driving her crazy, and she doesn't want Jacob to marry a Hittite woman, but to go get a wife from her relatives. I don't know exactly what drove her berserk with these Canaanite women, but something did. Now, in verse 2, you'll notice, if you have remembered our earlier study in Genesis, that when Esau's wives are mentioned here, they go by different names than they do earlier. Now, his wives are mentioned in Genesis, I believe, 26, verses 34 and 35, and Genesis 28, 9. We believe that Esau had three different wives. If that's true, then this account changes their name. Now, because one of the names is switched, but the same name, many of us feel like that there is some kind of a disruption in the transmission of the Hebrew text. There's been a lot of discussion about this. Does this speak about the inspiration of the Bible? No. I think it speaks to the fact that God spoke in a historical setting and that His Word was hand-copied for years. Now, some say it's the same women, but with two different names. Well, that is possible, but it's quite unusual that two of them would have the same names. And yet, when you look at this genealogy, well, really, it's just a list of different kinds of ancestors, not all of Esau, but all of the general geographical area of Edom, which would be south, east of the Dead Sea area. You find there are many duplicates of names. There have been some very good scholars who have said that possibly in Edom they like to use the same name over and over in families. And if that's true, that would explain some of the multiple use of these names. I think another way to possibly solve this tension is to say he had four wives, that Judith, mentioned first back in Genesis 26, didn't bear him any children, and maybe he married another wife. That's a possible solution. I was studying. I have finished a degree up at Trinity Evangelical, and one of the men up there is Gleason Archer. And this is his book on the Encyclopedia of Bible Difficulties. And he really tries to explain some of these discrepancies from different archaeological and historical possibilities. And he does a good job on this on page 99 through 101. And if you're interested in possible discrepancies in the Bible, then I think his book would be very helpful to you. There's possibly four wives. The rabbis say that the reason these wives' names change is to show that the children were illegitimate. Now, again, I think that's more rabbinical bias than it is historical fact. It takes the first wife, Judith, to mean Jewess, and they say that means that Esau named her this to play like she was not an idolater anymore, to trick Isaac into trusting him. Well, I'm not sure of that. The other name is Basemath, and that apparently meant perfume or incense, and the Jews would say this means she offered incense to idols, but again, I think their bias is showing. I was amazed that a Brown, Driver, and Briggs, probably the best lexicon in Hebrew, lists many of these Hebrew names and their meaning, but you have to remember that these names are very dubious at times, and we just can't be certain about that. And since I don't believe in allegory through here, I don't think the names are that significant. Well, these different daughters are mentioned, and notice they're called a Hittite. Now, in the Bible, there are seem to be three different uses of the term Hittite. If it is true that this is the same woman described in chapter 26:34, then they are called by all three names: Hittite, Hivite, and Horite. Now, these three names have really caused the miseries to Old Testament translators. Let me do the word Hittite first. There are three possible origins of this term. One goes back to the Table of Nations in early part of Genesis, Genesis 10, I believe. And it shows that this is from the sons of Heth, of the Canaanites. Possibly a non-Semitic origin. There seem to be three different geographical locations of these Hittite people. They're mentioned several different times in the Bible, but the name does not always mean the same. In some passages like this, the word Hittite seems to be connected with the word Hivite. Now, some have asserted that the Jews did not recognize these people, and therefore they changed the name Hivite to show this is not another Hittite like the non-Semitic group we often call the Hurrians. And yet again, this group of Hivites or Horites around the nation of Edom, their names through here seem to be Semitic. And so maybe we have another confusion of words, kind of like Cush. Their people of Cush are over close to the Tigris-Euphrates, and yet down in Africa also. The name has been confused because of its similarity. Maybe the same thing is true here in connection with the term Hivite and Horite. Now, Horite is from a Hebrew word that means miner or cave dweller. And most scholars would say it's a different group than the non-Semitic Hurrians by which this title is usually identified. Just to say to you, here is a good place for you to look at your study Bibles, your encyclopedia, your handbooks, to kind of show you the different technical way these names are used. For they're used in several different ways in the Old Testament. Now, it's interesting to me that the second wife's name, and boy, it's a foot and a half long. it's surprising that over in the latter part, she seems to be listed twice. Now, she's listed here in verse 2, but she's listed again over in verse 14 along with her children, along with the grandchildren. Now, many scholars would say that for some reason, her children are being depreciated to the level of grandchildren. I don't know why that would be true, but it is obvious that there is a definite repeat of her name and her children in this second section. And interestingly enough, over here in verse 41, this same feminine name is used for a man who is one of the tribal heads of Edom. So it's a feminine form, very unusual. This whole chapter is extremely difficult to kind of ferret out as far as how it's related. Now, notice it mentioned that the daughter of Anath, the granddaughter of Zibeon. Now, notice if you have some translation that doesn't have the granddaughter, but just has the daughter of. It seems to imply that Anath is a woman. But if you look over at verse 20, it's obvious that he is a son. Well, now there's several possibilities here. The word ben for son is very close to the word for daughter. And maybe there's a scribal error here in the Masoretic text. As a matter of fact, the Samaritan Pentateuch would change this to son. And we have that, let's see, in the Samaritan Pentateuch, the Septuagint, and the Syriac translation called the Peshitta has son of Zibeon. But another possibility is that these names in Hebrew are so fluid, they can cover many different relatives. And even the word son can mean son, grandson, great-grandson, that kind of thing. So the word for here can mean several things. But I think grandson is probably a good translation. Then it says, the Hivite. And, of course, here he is. Hivite seems to be related to Horite. Later on in the chapter where he's mentioned again, you see that in verse 20, and he's mentioned again in verse 24. And notice again, it says in verse 20, also Bethmath, Ishmael's daughter. Now, if you look back at chapter 28, verse 9, you remember that what Esau did was he knew his parents were upset because he married some Canaanite women, these Hittite and Hivite women. So he went and tried to marry one of Ishmael's daughter to gain the respect and possibly the blessing of his father. And so this is an account of that. But the funny thing, in Genesis 28:9, her name is spelled differently, a totally different name. Now, it's the Hebrew word for pardon. The Jews say he was pardoned by God for his sins when he married in his own line. Oh, I think, again, that's that Jewish bias against Ishmael. But why these names are different, I just do not know. It's very difficult to kind of sort all this out. It's interesting to me that in the Samaritan Pentateuch, which is a Hebrew translation of the books of Moses, that they change the name in Genesis 28:9 and in 36:3, 4, and 10 to this, I think you pronounce it, let's see, Ma'aleth, and the word for pardon. Now notice it says the sister of Naboth, and of course the reason for that is that Ishmael has already died and the brother gave the sister away. I think that's the reason for that there. And then it begins to list some of these sons. Matter of fact, a pretty good division of this chapter is that verses 2 through 8 talk about the sons that were born to Esau while he was still in Canaan, while verses 9 through 14 seem to refer mostly to the grandchildren that were born after he moved to Mount Seir, or Edom, which is southeast of the Dead Sea. And then the rest of the chapter seems to break down. In verses 15 through 19 and verses 40 through 43, some of the tribal leaders of this area are spoken of. And then in verses 20 through 30, some of the natives of this particular land, which are called Horites, their different leaders are spoken of. Now, from Deuteronomy, I believe it's chapter 2, let me see if I can find it, verse 12, it implies that the descendants of Esau conquered these Horites. But when you look at verses 20 through 20 and following, it seems they intermarried with them. And so we're not sure if that happened after the conquest or if they just kind of amalgamated. But you see some of the difficult history connected with this chapter. And then in verses 31 through 39 are some of the kings of Edom. And these kings are kind of like the judges in Israel. They're just over a little geographical area, maybe like a city or surrounding area, and their reigns are not sequential, but overlapping, probably contemporaries with each other. Now, notice, again, this is lists several of these sons down through here, and you can read that. There's a partial genealogy that's almost like this chapter found in 1 Chronicles chapter 1, verses 35 through 54. Again, some of the names vary, but to tell you the truth, the names of all the genealogies throughout the Bible that are recorded in different books differ. Even the genealogy of Jesus found in Matthew and Luke differs. We're not exactly sure. It's obvious that people went by more than one name, and that may be the problem here. I just can't be certain. Now, notice where it mentions, "Then Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughters, and all his household, his livestock and his cattle, and all his goods which he had acquired in the land of Canaan, and he went to another land away from his brother Jacob." And then verse 7 describes, "For their property was too great for them to live together, and the land which they sojourned could not sustain them because of their livestock." Now, there are several possibilities here. When Jacob came home, he had a large flock with him, herds of many different kinds of domesticated animals. He also inherited most of his father's stock. Now, some say that Esau did not really leave Canaan until Jacob came back. But there's a real problem in that, because if you look back at Genesis 32, particularly, let me see if I can find it. I believe it's 32:3, Genesis 32:3, and chapter 33, you'll see that really Esau is already in Mount Seir. It says he came from Mount Seir to meet Jacob. Well, some say that most of these nomadic tribes, that he moved between Mount Seir, which is Edom, south of the Dead Sea, and Canaan to water his flock, and that he moved back and forth until Jacob came with large herds, and then he just stayed in the area of Seir, or Edom. And I think that's probably a better understanding. Now, it implies here that he left because there wasn't enough grazing rights. The truth is because he sold his inheritance, and the land where Jacob lived, the land of promise, the land of Canaan, belonged to Jacob. And so it's a little different motive here, but the fact is he had to leave because it was Jacob's inheritance. Now, maybe he was taking care of it till Jacob got back, but now that Jacob was back, he had to leave. Then in verses 8 and following, and my New American Standard, in my opinion, doesn't break the paragraphs right here. A paragraph should be broken in verse 9 that mentions the children that were born after he went to Edom. Now, Edom has really, we say, well, why talk about Edom so much? Take a whole chapter with all these names. Why do that? Well, Edom, of course, was a relative of Israel and therefore was intimately connected with her. There's a real series of passages where the Jews are commanded to be kind to the Edomites. Numbers 20, verse 14, Deuteronomy 23, verses 7 and 8. But throughout the Old Testament, we see a real tension between the Edomites and the Jews. Let me give you a few passages where this tension is shown. Very early, Numbers 20, verses 14 through 21, Judges 11, 16 and 17, 1 Samuel 14, verses 47 and 48, 2 Samuel 8, 14, 1 Kings 11, 14 through 25, 2 Kings 14, 22, and also 2 Kings 16, 5 and 6, 2 Chronicles 20, verses 10 and 30, 2 Chronicles 21, verses 8 through 15, Amos chapter 1, verses 6 through 9. So these all record tensions or wars or battles between Esau or Edom and the Jewish people. Now, there's also several prophecies that relate to the destruction of Edom. Let me give you a few of those. Isaiah 34, 5 and following. Isaiah 63, 1 and following. Jeremiah 49, 7 through 22. Lamentations 4, 21 through 22. Ezekiel 26, 12 and following. Ezekiel 35, 1 and following. Ezekiel 36, 2 through 6. Amos chapter 1, verse 11 and 12. And the whole book of Obadiah. My, now you see why this chapter is in the Genesis. This nation had a profound impact on the nation of Israel. And so this Esau's genealogy is developed because of the tensions and problems and prophecies. Particularly Obadiah is severe against this nation of Edom. Now it mentions some of the children of Esau's children. And it's interesting that a concubine of Esau's son, Eliphaz, is mentioned in verse 12. Now, why bring up a concubine? Because her son is going to be Amalek. And the Amalekites are a fierce enemy of Israel throughout their history. And it's kind of brought up here in a derogatory sense that it's not really a full son, but the son of a concubine. Now, when we come to Eliphaz, it's interesting for me to know that Eliphaz of Teman sounds like the book of Job. Matter of fact, down here in verse, let me see if I can find it. Yeah, verse 28, we have the land of Uz. Because of these two connections, many think the book of Job is an Edomite book from the geographical location of Edom. Now, Eliphaz, the Teamite, Edom was known for its wisdom. Teman was known for its wisdom. And so it fits very much into that, and that may be a real possibility. Now, another, let's see. Oh, yeah, let's go down to verse 15 for a minute, and notice this listing of chiefs. Now, chief here is the Hebrew word for thousands, and it's also the word for tribe. So this is tribal leaders, okay? And most of the sons are mentioned. So Esau's sons rose to a level of tribal leaders. Now, these tribes, because they're herdsmen and nomadic, would kind of spread out to take care of their herds. They couldn't live together. They would have to disperse for pasture land, and they each became a head of one of these nomadic tribes. I want to make a brief aside here. This word for thousand or chief is one of the difficult words to translate. Many of the number problems in the Old Testament are related to the fact that we're not sure when to translate it thousand or when to translate it tribe. And that has caused us really some problems in translation. Now notice in verse 19, it mentions again the sons of Esau, that is Edom. It does this several times through this chapter, reminding us again and again that the nation of Edom came from Esau. And it just does it over and over. Now in verse 20, we have some of the sons of Seir, here called a Horite. From Deuteronomy 2:12, it says that the Edomites dispossessed the Horites as the Jews dispossessed the Canaanites. And yet in this particular account, it talks about intermarriage. Now there's two ways that can happen. One way, after you conquer a people, you could take their women in marriage. Or one way you could coexist for a while in someone else's land is to marry their daughters. Which of this it is, we just can't be sure. But later on, this group of native people, Horites, will be dispossessed pretty much. Now notice in verse 24, we have mentioned about one of these sons that found some hot springs. And I want to pick up on that for a minute because this is a way to show you how problematic it is to translate some of these Hebrew words. This is the only place in the Hebrew Bible this word appears. It's the consonantal stem YMM. Now some say it means hot springs. That comes from the Vulgate, which is about 380 A.D. Others say no, the term comes from the Septuagint, where it's simply the Hebrew is just transliterated, not translated, so we still don't know what it means. Now, the second thing it means, number three, it could mean vipers, and that's what some scholars say, the same consonants. Others say, no, if you change the letters around to YMM to MYM, you get the word for water, and that's really important. She found water in the desert, and so that's what the Peshitta or the Syriac has. Some of the rabbis said, no, it means mules. Now, mules, you know, is a cross between a donkey and a horse, and they can't have children. And it was the rabbi's way of saying, see, these people are weird folks. They're going to be cut off. They're not going to have any descendants. And, of course, Obadiah says that'll be true, too. But, again, I think mules is just the rabbi's bias, not a good translation. The Samaritan Pentateuch has the word E-M, E-M-I-M, which we learned from Deuteronomy 2:10 meant the giants. They found the giants in the desert. Now, from the context, we know that geographically there are hot springs in this area, and that's probably where Jerome picked up on. Water is found in the desert. Vipers are found in the desert. There's a real possibility that the sons of Anak or the giants were out there, so we just don't know how to translate this. Notice down, I think it's interesting, in verse 31, some of these kings are mentioned, but again, they're mentioned by cities and not, they weren't contemporaneous of the whole, sequential for the whole country. It's interesting to note that in verse 32, need to pick up on, the son of Peor. Now, that's the same father as Balaam mentioned in Numbers 22 through 24 that the king of Moab hired to curse Israel, but he couldn't do it. This is the guy whose donkey talked to him. Now, the consonants of Bela are very close to Balaam. Balaam. And so maybe it's the same guy, but we just can't be certain. But the father's name is the same. Now, notice if you would, let's see. Oh, yeah, verse 37, that's interesting. We have somebody named Saul, very similar to the king of Israel. Many people try to relate this to King Saul, and the other man's name, Baal-Hanan down here, changed the name Baal to El, and this is the name of the guy who killed Goliath's brother, and they say, see, it may be another name for David, but I think that's reading too much. Anyway, this man came from my New American Standard Bible has the Euphrates River with the term Euphrates in italics in verse 37, which means it's not in the Masoretic text. Usually this term for river, when it has the river, is used for the Euphrates. But there are sometimes it's not. And I think this is probably a local river in Edom this man came from and probably should not be. The same is true of some of the problems in translating. In verse 39, the term Hadar is probably the best translation, but the Jewish Bible has the term Hadad, which is a characteristic name for the rulers of Syria. But I think most manuscripts have Hadar is what should be there. But I'm trying to show you the problems we have through here. Let's see. And notice again in verse 43, Edom, that is Esau, the father of the Edomites. It goes back and tries to pick up this very same theme again. Now, I wish I had more information for you. I think this will be the chapter you want to look up, something like The History of Israel by John Bright, or look up Hivite and Horite and Hittite in your Bible dictionary. But basically, it's emphasis on Esau and the nation that came out of him, that though a relative of the Jews would be so cruel to them that God would utterly destroy them. And later on, the Nabataean Arab Empire would take over their country, and they would cease to exist and are no longer an ethnic group. And so it comes out of the judgment of God. Well, I hope it's been interesting to you. I think it's is one of those chapters you don't get a whole lot about the Christian life from, but it is part of the Word of God, and I think it'll help us understand the rest of the Old Testament. I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.